Hello, and welcome to Movies We Dig, the podcast about film, antiquity, and everything in between. I'm Colin McCormick.
I'm Elijah Fleming.
And I'm Christy Vogler.
And today we have maybe the perfect film for this podcast, or maybe the perfect film for me to discuss on this podcast, but we are talking about Titus, the 1999 film adaptation of Will Shakespeare's revenge tragedy, Titus Andronicus, starring Anthony Hopkins, Jessica Lange, and directed by Julie Taymor. And joining us today, we have a special guest who is here by request, or this film is here by request, because I was unfamiliar with this film before he brought it up. But we are joined by the ever wonderful Dr. Pramit Chowdhury from UT Austin, an old sort of return guest. I think this is now your third appearance, something like that.
I didn't even remember what the other
I know we definitely did Last Legion. I remember that explicitly.
Because I remember you. They had Aishwarya Rai and I,
Yes. There was a very thin connection between your Calcutta Art House podcast via Aishwarya Rai, who's been in, I think, one Bengali film, maybe two.
She's in one Bengali film, which is the only reason that we watched it for our work. And then she was in this completely random, like, classics themed movie.
Yes. So sometimes, you know, in our world and in the world of classical literature and myth, all you need is the barest thread to make some sort of connection.
It is the enabling condition of our empire. Yeah.
Exactly. So we're talking Shakespeare. We'll start off with you, Pramit. What's sort of your experience with Titus, and do you dig this movie?
I do, 100%. Yeah. Though I inflict this on students repeatedly. Like a bludgeon, like the play itself. There's no subtlety. It's just semester after semester, just whatever excuse I have to kind of somehow fit it into a syllabus, I'll take it. So mostly in classical myth, but yeah.
Yeah. Did you see it in theaters?
I did. Yeah. So a friend of mine who's into theater, like he would act at school and at college. He was like, oh, you know, Julie Taymor's a genius. I was like, I have to pretend I know who this person is. Like, I had no idea who she was. And he's like, oh, she's a genius. And you have to see this. And it has Anthony Hopkins. And this guy adored Anthony Hopkins. I think he adored the Beatles, James Bond, and Anthony Hopkins. Those are like the three pillars of British
culture, right?
Yeah. Like, self-identity or whatever. But anyway, so I was like, okay, fine. And so I watched it and I was like, oh, check. Yeah, that is actually amazing. So, and then I didn't then watch it again until I started teaching it. So whatever, 10 years later or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I went through a whole, like, and it's present. I think, I don't know if Christy and Eli, because we have like a Google Doc sometimes that I just sort of type my notes into the phone as I'm watching. And I went through a whole arc of like, this movie is nuts. Do I secretly love this movie? Or is this movie holding me hostage? And have I developed Stockholm Syndrome for this movie? That was like kind of the development of my thought. Because by the end, I'm like, maybe this is a genius movie. I don't know. Like,
it definitely had its like moments for sure. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, maybe it's too smart for it. So I have no idea. We'll come back around to like our final verdict of how, if or why and how this movie is a success, which I kind of think it is. Or an underappreciated masterpiece. But Christy and Eli, I assume like me, this was your first exposure to Titus.
Yes.
Yeah, this was my first exposure to the movie. But I was actually kind of excited because when I was an undergrad, my very first year of Whitman College, they had this outdoor amphitheater that you could sit in. And they were putting on a play. And it just happened to be Titus Andronicus. And the two brothers, or sons of Tamora, like they played them like Southern hicks, like, and so it was played up really funny, still very gruesome, but you know, it's a bunch of college kids. And I've also, you know, been to see a play in the Globe Theater in London, and you sometimes, and this will be a thought, a question I'll pose to you all, is like, what's great about Shakespeare plays, whether it's historical or whether it's tragedy or whatever he's doing, it's always meant to be funny to a certain degree. And so there was times I was watching the movie and it's like, is this, you know, taking itself a little too seriously like modern Shakespeare theater likes to do sometimes? Or, you know, are they trying to be funny? So like I had so much going through my head and nostalgia, but it was also split screen with like grading on one side. So like this is a kind of film that's like, I think I'm going to really enjoy this and I really need to watch it like paying more attention. But like it was a lot of nostalgia for me and like Easter eggs of actual Greek and Latin material. So it was just fun in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I had never seen this before. I feel like I had never really heard of this before. And I was trying to find it anywhere on streaming to watch it. And I was like, guys, where is this movie? And I was kind of surprised. It's like, it has a lot of awesome people in it. And it's like a really incredibly well-made movie. And I'm like, why isn't this anywhere? And it's on YouTube. So
the answer is because this movie cost something like $18 million and grossed worldwide a total of $3 million. Sure. I think that's the reason no one ever talks about it and everybody forgets about it and wants to bury it, because it was very much not a commercial success and divisive, I think, on the critical side of things.
That doesn't surprise me, but like, I am a sucker for all things Shakespeare. I love reading the plays. I love going to see the plays. I love the cheesy like high school adaptations that people make. I love 10 Things I Hate About You. So it's like, if it's Shakespeare, I'm like very into it. And I remembered watching the scene where he is about to like butcher them to make them into pies. I remember the, what was it? The Abridged Shakespeare Company. Did you guys ever see that? It was like,
oh yeah, it's like the sort of light theater. It's like, yeah, all the guys kind of in the, like, they're in the round doing
the complete works of Shakespeare abridged, and they like have this like very short, like very bloody, screamy representation of Titus Andronicus, and it's like blood coming out of, you know, hand stumps, and but he like says that monologue. He's like, "Of your blood, I will grind your bones, and I will make a paste." And I was like, "Oh, that's so cool."
I had two thoughts, which is, one, I think this is maybe the bloodiest Shakespeare play ever. I think by my count, there was like 10 dead bodies, 3 missing hands, and 2 decapitations by the end of the film, something like that.
I think some of the histories get equally high body counts, but they're like not all on stage.
Yeah. The body count actually might also be conservatively low, because I think Tamara's son at the very beginning.
Oh, yeah.
There might be some people that slipped through the cracks. But I was going to say, just on the speaking of like grind your bones into dust, maybe we'll just lead off. But this, I texted my partner sort of late at night. I was like, well, I think I just found the greatest Shakespeare line ever, which is in Act 4, Scene 2, where Chiron goes, "You have undone our mother." And he goes, "Villain, I have done your mother."
Harold Bloom said there isn't a memorable line in the play. And I was like, that's just not true.
That's just not true.
So I guess this is kind of my first question, which is, you know, this play, I mean, the film wasn't a success, and this play is probably Shakespeare's most maligned work, arguably. And then some people even want to say that, like, oh, it's just young Shakespeare, or it wasn't really him, or something like that. But to Harold Bloom, I think he's famously one of the defenders, where his point is like, this play only sucks if you take it at face value, which, and now is sort of the through line, which is why I suspect Promet likes this movie, because as I know this professionally, as a sort of long defender of works which are maligned, you know, by the critical consensus, I'm thinking specifically of Silius Italicus, but I can see the through line of like the natural impulse to be like, maybe this is actually secretly genius.
So doesn't Bloom also say that, like, if it were filmed, it should be directed by Mel Brooks? Like,
Yeah, he thought it should be, like, his read is that it should be comedy kind of through and through, because it is so over the top. Because it is, like, when you watch this movie, like, everybody is cartoonishly awful and, like, dumb and petty and just, like, horrible to one another. And even just, like, the plot itself is, like, patently dumb. Where, like, by the end, where Tamara is like, you know what will really drive Anthony Hopkins over the edge, or Titus, is I'm going to dress up like revenge and pretend to be a personification of revenge. And that will really seal the deal. Which, of course, backfires, because he knows what's up and uses it as an excuse to kidnap her son so he can turn them into meat pies.
It's like a very early version of like the play within the play and Hamlet, right? But this is like grappling with that idea, but in a very comical way.
I had two notes, which is, one is like, is it really a Shakespeare play if a man doesn't go visibly insane on stage in front of you? And then two, is it a Shakespeare play if nobody dresses up and puts on a show of their own?
Yep.
Which I feel like the two hallmarks of, like,
yeah, that moment was definitely a moment where it's just like I'm grading on one side and I look over, I'm like, wait, what is happening? So I have to like back up a little bit, look at the like plot description and Wikipedia. I'm like, oh, That's what's happening.
I mean, I guess, like, this is my question to you first, which is, like, how did you read this or respond? Like, what was your arc? Because I was taking it, I thought the film was taking itself very, very seriously. And then I, by the end, I was like, no, I should go back and rewatch it, like, purely sort of farcically.
So I endorse, I never quizzed my friend on why he was like, Julia Taymor's a genius. I think it was because she had won the MacArthur Award or whatever. Sometime,
made the right? Lion King.
And yeah, I don't know if he'd seen it. Yeah, so I haven't seen the Lion King musical. Has any of you seen it?
I have seen it. I've seen it. Yeah.
So I've only seen like clips of it on like TV and stuff like that. I mean, it looks pretty impressive. So really, I only know her work from this. But my take is that she is serious, but she understands the role of humor within the artwork. So if you listen to her interview, I think she has an interview with Charlie Rose, the now disgraced Charlie Rose. She has an interview from like just after the film was released. And she cites this classic 1950s version by Peter Brook starring Laurence Olivier as like the straight version of Titus Andronicus, where they actually cut out more of the over-the-top humorous elements. And so he takes that as a, you know, in some ways fastidious, impressive, but kind of misreading of the play. So if you ask her what she, you know, what themes she privileges, she's always talking about serious themes like violence and madness, like the stuff that you would get. Like there's no humor to it at all. But then when you hear about the version that she's reacting against, she's highlighting humor as an element that she's kind of putting back in. So it's funny that she has these kind of two different ways of talking about the film. So I think she's able to maintain both. And I think that drives audiences a little crazy in the same way. So it's, Colin, it's interesting you bring up all of the stuff that I kind of work on or used to work on professionally, which does the same thing. It drives people wild because it seems as if it's kind of missing the target every time. But a lot of, I'm not hardly the only person who is saying, well, it's not that it's trying to be comedic and it's not that it's trying to be tragic. It's that it's trying to do both. And that's an inherently very difficult thing to do. And I think she's trying to do the same thing. And from what I've heard of her talking about the production, it seems that way. There's a great scene. There's a behind the scenes video of the making of it. And Harry Lennox and Jessica Lange are doing that scene in the forest, like that very sexualized scene where they're kind of like seducing each other, and Harry Lennox is standing up when they're just doing it on a, you know, in a room, and Taymor and I can't remember who else is standing in the background, and Taymor stops them and has him kind of sit down on the ground and has Jessica Lange kind of embrace him with her legs, as the way you see it in the film as it's actually produced, and they're kind of laughing and, you know, really getting into like the sensuality of it, and you understand from seeing the behind the scenes the production of it that they clearly had the kind of the serious and the comedic elements side by side like throughout the making of it. But I don't know how you get an audience to dig that.
If they vote with their dollars, then clearly they didn't. But
they didn't, exactly. Yeah. Well, and I might have just been 10 years too early. Like, I could see this film having been released in 2019 doing a hell of a lot better than it did in 1990.
I agree.
Yeah, I think we weren't ready for it. As I say that, like, because I was 9, I was definitely not ready for it. you showed this to me back in 1999. I would have been like, I am scared and uncomfortable, and I need an adult.
As you should have been.
That was the problem we talked about with Thor, Love and Thunder too, right? Like, it's dealing with some really heavy topics, but it's trying to bring some levity in there with humor, and it doesn't jive that well. Like, that's a really hard balance to strike. And I do appreciate that this film was trying to, like, Anthony Hopkins serving up pie dressed up as a chef, and someone's like, why are you dressed like that? You can tell there's intentionality in the humor at times, which I do appreciate, because
also, like, he serves a, like, comically silly meat bug. Yeah. When that pie hits the plate, you're like, good Lord. Like,
yeah, that was hard to watch.
Even if it were made of, like, an approved meat source, I still would be incredibly uncomfortable to watch anybody eat that pie.
Yeah,
it's like a meatloaf in a pie crust. Like, I don't know how else to describe it.
Yeah, and I think that's what I appreciated, is like eventually I picked up on like there was intention of like humor, and like that's always been my sense of Shakespeare. you know, people have always derided Titus Andronicus as like, oh, this is not good work and everything like that. But like my understanding is he's writing for a general public, in part making fun of his own highbrow education, if he is who we think he is, and how like, you know, this is the Renaissance period. Here's high art and we've got to hold it on such a pedestal. But it's like the stories you're telling, you know, I'm teaching Roman Civ this semester and we've gotten to the conclusion by the end of the semester. It's like, I don't think Rome was never not a hot dumpster fire the entire time.
Accurate.
We can look at the ridiculousness of some of those stories that were foundational to Rome, and Shakespeare's doing the same thing. It's like, we're, you know, trying to treat this as highbrow art and Renaissance and like, oh, look how great it is. And yet what is actually happening is abhorrent on so many levels. Mm. And it should be funny to think like, this is artistic. So
I think you hit on just it, where like Shakespeare adaptations are always kind of tricky because of the whole thing of like, do we do something wildly new with setting and costuming, which we should talk about, but or like, what do you do about the language? And there's always that impulse, particularly with the dramas, less so with the comedies, to, you know, like with the Macbeths and the Hamlets, to like ascribe to them this like awe of like, they've reached this sort of totemic magisterial position and we need to treat it with reverence. Whereas a play like this that kind of falls somewhere in the middle and is sort of, and it is like its humor of, you know, it's humor derives from it so self-serious and so over the top. And so like you crank drama up to 11 and then it whips around and becomes comedy.
I think I see this with, I'm thinking of Chiron and Demetrius, Tamora's sons. One of them is a very, very young Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, which like I had to do a double take. It was like
watching him do watching him do like a cage dance, like, and you can't be like this is not a
pigtails. Yeah, like, no, this is terrifying. But I think like they were comedic, I would argue. Mm. Like they were weird and wacky and crazy, but they were also really scary. And like I think they were both of those things, and there was some part of this like humorous chaos that you just like felt anything could happen, that they could literally do anything, and that was so terrifying. So they were extremely upsetting, but I would like, I was laughing, and so I think that was a weird place to be watching this. But I kind of agree with just the over-the-topness of it all, and but I think maybe comedic also doesn't have to necessarily be humorous, if that makes sense. Like it was still scary. And I was laughing like out of nervousness. It's too scary.
That scene. Oh, that's also, I mean, that's the I've done your mother scene. But like in that scene where like it has one of my favorite tropes from movie, or not tropes, I guess, but like facets of a movie that I am obsessed with and I love, which is like different decades depiction of like wayward or like aberrant youth or something like that. I'm reminded of just, this is a very weird reference, but in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, like they're like the version of like despondent, wayward, violent youth, or like all these kids hanging out in like a warehouse with like skateboards and arcade games and stuff like that. And like this was like that, but for the 90s, where they're hanging out wearing like leather overalls.
Yeah,
like just the way they're hanging out, playing some strange Italian video game called Radical Bikers. There's, and it just, you know, and the, like, even just like the way their hair is done and things like that.
So I should get in that on the historical side, there was kind of a consensus in like the early 2000s that I think is still persistent, that the play actually is a jointly written play. So there'd been this controversy, this like 100-year-old controversy, and people hadn't liked the play for quite a long time, even before that. But someone had pointed out, like in the early 20th century, that there was something just fundamentally weird about the diction and various other aspects of the play. And, you know, I won't go into all of the, like, there's a lot of like technical stylometric stuff to do with like the proportion of the vocabulary that is attributable to Shakespeare. And like, there are some idiosyncratic terms. And so they settled on this guy, George Peele, who is a very highly educated Latinate dramatist, who wrote nothing that's like popular in the way that, you know, it didn't have lasting popularity in the way that Shakespeare's works did. But he was actually pretty successful at the time. And then the belief was that he and Shakespeare basically co-authored this. And there are a few other co-authored works as well. So some people think that the reason that it's more classical is precisely because of this co-authorship, that Peel was the, you know, the more classically educated of the two. So that, yes, Shakespeare was steeped in the classics, and as much as anyone who went to a grammar school in the Elizabethan period was going to have some understanding of the classics. But on top of that, this other person who was kind of hyper-classical, George Peel, was upping the classical content of the play. So interestingly, like I worked on this for a little bit because there are actually some Latin quotations in the play that Tamar obviously takes out. Like, it made for terrible film, right? To have like Latin just quoted in the film, so she takes it out. But I remember writing about this in a completely academic context, and some person on the internet got really angry at me. Yeah.
What? Internet anger? Never. About something as minute as Latin in Titus Andronicus?
So they're like a realtor or something in California, but they're like a very serious independent scholar on, say, Shakespeare and authorship, but they hold a highly idiosyncratic position on Shakespeare and authorship, like really, really out there. But they hold it very strongly, and they've done a lot of work on it. And this person simultaneously has the habit of both wanting other people to engage with them, but tweeting really negative things about your work as they simultaneously write you to try and get you.
Oh my God.
So what's weird is they've been doing it for years, and they seem really puzzled that they haven't like increased their engagement. they haven't considered that maybe this is like a suboptimal strategy.
watch their listening.
Certainly not.
We have maybe we'll get a eureka moment.
So this is the position now generally held that it's, you know, this collaborative play. And one idea that I quite like, there's no way of really proving it, is that one of the reasons this play is so obsessed with like twinning and brothers and competition is not just because like the classical, you know, thematics that it inherits from Seneca. Like it's pretty clearly one of the most Senecan plays that Shakespeare writes, right? Like Seneca is the model for all of these dramatists, right? Much more so than Greek tragedy. And, you know, this is hyper Seneca. But in addition to that, I do wonder about like the different aesthetic sensibilities and experiences of these two guys putting together this play, where you have literally like the opening act seemingly by one person, like the majority of the rest by Shakespeare, but then a couple of scenes here and there by this other person.
It's like the theatrical side of a cut of Justice League, where you can visibly tell which parts are Joss Whedon inserts and which parts are Zack Snyder, because you'd be hard pressed to find two more sort of disparate stylists. Although some
people hate that, but I mean, I don't know about Justice League, but people hate that in this play, but I actually love it. Like I like the alternations from like one register to another register, from one scene to another.
We should sort of add for the audience's sake that sort of, so the plot is purely sort of fabrication, right? There was no sort of all the people and the names and the events are sort of invention by either Shakespeare or Shakespeare and Peel.
So there's one possible exception to that, which is there is this very obscure like translation of Herodian's history, that like second, third century AD history, which has like an emperor Bassianus, who's like super cruel. And it might be that Peel / Shakespeare are using some of that as a basis for this plot. But I wouldn't stress too much about the role of that in determining Titus.
But to your point, it is this sort of like my kind of, maybe this is reductive, but like my sort of thesis was like, in the way that if you watch A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, you basically have gotten like their primer on Roman comedy, where like it's kind of all of, it's none of the Roman comedies, but it's like all of them in one. Right. And I feel like if you watch this, you kind of have gotten the primer on Roman tragedy, you know, where it is sort of all of Seneca's tragedies. I mean, most obviously where the part where somebody enacts revenge by killing somebody's family members and feeding them to him.
Yeah.
But the kind of all the plots are all like sort of these stock, or not stock, but there are these famous plots from Roman history and tragedy involving rape and mutilation and revenge and cannibalism and filicide. The list goes on. Yeah. But it's kind of this accretion. And it gets sort of doubly meta, because the sort of plot point is that the way Lavinia, who herself is a sort of homage to a very famous Roman story about a woman named Lavinia, who is assaulted by a tyrant son. She communicates her sort of message via the Metamorphoses, Ovid's Metamorphoses, in which that poem, there is a very famous victim of rape, Io, who communicates her sort of assault by Jupiter by writing it in the sand. So there's these, like, I don't know how to describe, like, I don't know, like, what the layers. Appropriate geometric shape is for this, like.
Stratigraphy. It's like layers on layers on layers.
Yes.
Stracciatella. I don't know. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Well, and I was trying to, like, be smart on the Shakespeare side of things. So there's this one part from the person who was writing on the play, Catherine Eisman Mouse, and she just points out that going to Seneca, in that, like, Shakespeare and Peele were just trying to top every version of this, and they point to a particular Seneca quote: "An act is not revenge," writes the ancient tragedian Seneca, "unless it is surpassed." Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that felt like a dare that Seneca put out there for future playwrights. They're like, on it.
I mean, yeah, Seneca, his if you read, you know, his tragedies, it's incredibly over, you know, maybe even excessive, but they're super violent, super gory, super, you know, I mean, the part where I'm just thinking in the sort of the Thyestes, which is the play famously that has the depiction of a guy chopping up another dude's sons and feeding them to him. There's like a whole elaborate description of that going on. And it's like a lion doing this. And
mm-hmm. Yep.
Titus also basically quotes that bit from Seneca. Mm-hmm. So in the scene where he and Lavinia are looking down at the puddle, and you see their reflection in the puddle, where he's like finally figured out that, like, it's no good being Titus. He has to be like mental Titus, right?
Yep.
Like,
yep.
He has to take on that persona. So at that point, he basically quotes the Seneca, which is exactly like Medea and Atreus being like, I have to, like, the quickening must happen and I must become.
I mean, yeah, that's the kind of, like, everybody almost acts in this play is like a sort of super heightened everything, right? Everything's dialed up to 11 and the way everyone, and then the movie sort of plays it up where they have this, like, the palace is this, like, Great Gatsby orgy at all times.
Yeah.
And everyone just reacts in the most extreme way possible. And
I had the moment where I was like, at the very end, where all of a sudden we have the Matrix moment where it's like slow motion camera pan of spit flying in someone's face. And I'm like,
yeah,
wait, what happened first, Matrix or this? I'm not sure anymore.
And then you find out that it was a play all along. Like,
well, and that's, I think that's what's kind of interesting to think about. Like, we're dealing with so many different texts, and, you know, plays are based on oral, in a lot of ways, folklore and history. And Disney kind of does the opposite, where it, like, sanitizes all of the folk tales that we grew up with that are meant to be very violent, and they're meant to, like, deter you from certain behaviors. Mm-hmm. And it's weird that these plays kind of go the opposite direction. You can tell they're building off local tradition, folklores and everything, and then it's just kind of dialing it up to make it more abhorrent and therefore, as Elijah pointed out, like, funny. Or, like,
or
something,
also some sort of deterrent. Like, yeah. Don't cook people in a meat pie.
Well, I wrote this in my notes. This is like, is the more at the very end, like, kind of, there's a bit of a sort of speech that Lucius gives about sort of like, what are we meant to learn all? And, like, is the end of this play, is the moral just to not be like a crazy person? Like,
Lucius is pretty dubious, though, right?
Yeah. Like,
he's not much of a savior.
Truly,
I think
yeah.
All seriousness, the answer to that question is, because these are revenge plays, right? Revenge mm-hmm. isn't worth it, or it just begets more revenge that continues to outdo the previous action, which you could point to warfare being really similar. Like, that's what Euripides, a lot of his plays mm-hmm. were about, was like, let's question this whole war thing we do and, like, how that actually impacts just normal everyday people.
Right.
Exactly to that point, and to prime it with, like, Lucius himself is no, like, savior. He's not like the Fortinbras that comes in at the end of Hamlet. And it's like, I will bail Denmark out, because, like, my reaction at the very end was like, the very end of this play is the beginning of another play exactly like this play. Right? Mm-hmm. Where, like, act five of this play is act one of a different play, where it's like, oh yes, this family has been executed. Aaron has been executed and his child is taken off into exile. That child will probably grow up and come back to seek revenge on the Lucii or whoever, and like it's just going to be another sort of cycle of vendetic revenge.
Mm-hmm. Maybe don't do war is the answer.
I mean, that's definitely the import of the right, the contemporary material that mm-hmm. she puts in at the beginning and the end, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. she leaves it kind of vague in terms of its, you know, reference, but it is the 1990s. She's probably thinking about the former Yugoslavia, right? The kind of the obvious mm-hmm. reference of it. So yeah, I mean, I think she's trying to make an audience, I mean, she's directing it largely to an Anglo-American audience, right? And other audiences as well, but primarily an Anglo-American audience. And she is probably trying to make us more conscious of primal desires and risks that can occur in context that you might not expect to devolve so badly, but mm-hmm. that do.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, also the other like design aspect is the choice that like Rome is like very obviously fascist in this movie, where like they film scenes among like fascist architecture in Italy. Everybody dresses like fascists. It's like very clearly like this is a fascistic regime, which I mean, on one hand, it's like it doesn't take a great leap to go from, you know, ancient Rome to fascism because fascists themselves were incredibly into ancient Rome.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, yeah, that's part of it. We're like the whole thing. And I think it was my favorite sort of quote or tidbit was Scott Tobias, a critic for the AV Club, described Alan Cumming's Saturninus as a fascist Pee Wee Herman.
Can I just say that he was awesome?
Alan Cumming's great. He's one of those actors that I've never been disappointed by an Alan Cumming performance.
Right. And I think I, once again, with like the comedic terror, it was like he was so scary in mm-hmm. just like his over the topness. It was funny because he was like screaming and running and doing the most, but it was funny. But I was also like, something's going to go terribly wrong mm-hmm. at the same time. So there was that dread that came in on the end of that. So yes, an excellent performance.
So he does a table. There's a shot of the table reading in the behind the scenes documentary, and he's doing that. You know, it's slightly less polished than the version obviously you get in the movie, but you can see what he's trying to do in the table reading, and she's just laughing because she's clearly like seeing for the first time how he's gonna play it, and she's like, yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
I mean, there are a lot of people on top of their game. Like, there are a lot of people doing mm-hmm. their best, which is
yes. Yeah. It is a very sort of star-studded cast and a lot of really good performances. And even, I mean, Anthony Hopkins, like, he's going for it, which is mm-hmm. funny now because famously Anthony Hopkins is a guy where when he gets a script, he goes through the script, he highlights all of his lines, and then next to a bunch of them who write N-A-R, which stands for no acting required. And then he looks at the end where if it's passed muster for N-A-R, then he's like, I'll take the part. Case in point, Thor 2. But
wouldn't he literally cites himself doing Hannibal Lecter in this?
Yes.
Like,
I mean, that's the other. I mean, just we, you know, to dwell on Anthony Hopkins for a second, where like he's a man who was an actor for years and years, but then has this huge explosion in the 90s being Hannibal Lecter, and then so many parts that he sort of is called to do are just kind of reiterations on Hannibal Lecter. And Titus is a less suave and less in control Lecter, maybe. That's the way to describe it. I mean, he likes cooking people, but
yeah, but that's not how he starts out. He's like the Ned Stark in the beginning, right? Like, he just wants to do like the right thing, which is like, oh yeah, no, the eldest son gets to be emperor. He like doesn't
Even
matter.
He's clearly a lunatic.
Clearly a lunatic. And like, maybe we should think about this. But like, he's just doing like the right thing. And then mm-hmm. He kills his own son trying to do the right thing. So he's like trying to be this like super straight, honorable Ned Stark. And instead of just dying, he becomes Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
Right?
He sees it as an evolution of Hopkins' own career just like compressed into one movie, right?
Yes. So
Hopkins doing like The Remains of the Day, like really uptight, right, at the beginning, and then like going Hannibal Lecter, like when he actually kills Karen and Demetrius, but then incredibly like in the scene, I think this is even in the Wikipedia article, like in the final scene at the table, he makes his voice like Ralph Richardson, John Gielgud, and Laurence Olivier. So he like quotes most famous British Shakespearean actors like in this like in line after line. And so it's like Hopkins's whole career distilled, which he must have just done consciously from beginning to end.
Yeah. I love it. I mean, this is sort of semi-related, but I'm also reminded that when they re-released Spartacus and Laurence Olivier had died, there was a scene, there was like a final scene that didn't make into the theatrical cut with Laurence Olivier and Tony Curtis and like the Baz, where they're talking about like, do you prefer oysters or snails or whatever? And Anthony Hopkins was the one who dubbed over the lines to be the, he was like faux Laurence Olivier for that when they like had to do the new audio.
So I got to go back to the thing about fascism, because before we started recording, I mentioned Steve Bannon.
And you were surprised when we were like, you're like, I'm obviously going to talk about Steve Bannon. And we were like,
really?
Pramit's gone the full Titus. Like this.
What's this pie I'm getting in the mail?
This blew my mind because I actually only discovered this pretty late, I'm embarrassed to say, because like I've worked on this as like scholarship, like on the play itself, and I teach it, so I don't tend to Google the movie, because you know I tend to go to like JSTOR, look at bibliography and monographs and stuff. But then relatively recently, I discovered that Steve Bannon really loved Titus, like the Titus Andronicus, the play. And between the time that he worked for Goldman Sachs and Breitbart, he was in Hollywood for a while. And he has like a number of executive producer credits because he was basically into the financing of movies. And he was at a restaurant with a screenwriter. Like they introduced each other. And he was like, I love Titus, and I have this idea for how to make it into a Hollywood movie. And it was Titus Andronicus in space, and the Andronici were like beings of light, and they were in this Manichaean struggle with these shades. And Titus Andronicus, after like winning this battle on Mars, came down to Earth, and Earth was this realm of like corruption. And then there was this like apocalyptic struggle on Earth. This was written. The script is out there. It's even better than I could possibly make it out. There's like a sex scene which involves a dissolution into some kind of electrical plasma or something that's like very difficult to see how they were going to film it. But obviously it never ended up getting made. He also wrote a Coriolanus set during the LA riots, which is another thing that you have to read up about.
Yeah.
But he ended up being an executive producer for this film.
Oh.
So he optioned it, I think, I can't remember what the production company was, but he has a credit for this movie, which, yeah.
It's so perfect that like Steve Bannon would read this play and be like, yes, Titus Andronicus at the beginning of the play is a good man who can only be corrupted by him coming down to Earth, right? Like he starts out the play good and uncomplicated. This man who is a general,
Well, because you know the Goths, right? I mean that they come in and like make society worse. Yeah. It's every bit as literal as you would think.
Wow. Oh my god.
And it's funny you also mentioned Coriolanus, because that's, I mean, it's one of the other sort of Roman sort of historical plays. But there is, I was reminded, as I was watching this movie, I was reminded of there's like, I think a 2012 Coriolanus with Ralph Fiennes and Jared Butler that has a very similar kind of like fascist chic aesthetic going on.
Yeah, well, it's very military, right? Like they're all in like fatigues and boots the whole time,
and the Senate are dressed in sort of, they're all in like black suits, and Rome is Rome is sort of imagined as this, you know, like if Mussolini won kind of situation.
It's this Ian McKellen Richard III, right? That's like the reference point for all of that. I think it is. So I think they use the Square Colosseum as well as part of the scene for that movie. But I think that very much set the aesthetic for all of these Shakespearean fascist references.
Man, I'm looking for the Space Titus script. I want to find it.
It reminds me of the sequel to Gladiator in some respects that Colin brought up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, where Maximus goes to heaven and like fights with heaven and hell or something like that. Like, it's these kinds of scripts that are out there, and you're just like, really? And then part of you also almost wonders, like, I kind of want that. Like, just, you know, like the what if is like maybe too intriguing.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, apparently Bannon did not like the final version.
Bannon said if it made his version, then it would have actually made money.
That is what I am seeing, and it makes me so furious. Oh my God.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You should see the script for the Coriolanus is even more incredible, because it was there was a table reading for that as well, which apparently you can see. And Bannon attempts to, like, it's Steve Bannon's projection of the language of gang members. You can imagine how horrifying this is. Like, at some point, I think someone in the play says something like, I'm the OG gangster or something like that.
No.
Oh, Steve.
I come back to the, like, slightly out of touch projections of youth culture and, like, hip culture or, like, whatever.
Yeah, anyway, I've now sent you down a rabbit hole that you're not
really Yes, you really No, have.
Yeah, but, okay, but okay. Yeah, we'll Eli's, like, busy Googling anything. I know. I was going to say, another, like,
really trying to find it.
Another, like, aspect that, or not aspect, another influence to me that was very, very evident kind of in the first, like, opening credits and then kind of tapered off by the end was the first maybe 5 minutes of this movie to me felt very Fellini-esque of, like, you know, the soldiers in there, like, they're kind of like tin men and they're all covered in sort of mud and they're all marching in, like, uniform, and they're all of their uniforms and their armor and their costumes is, like, evocative of some kind of ancient dress, but is very stylized and, you know, over the top. And just reminds me of the way, like, Fellini sort of depicts, you know, in his Satyricon, where it's like, it almost feels like sort of surreal and dream or like nightmare. Like, I mean, really the first, like the opening credit with the kid and the action figures at the table, and then his house gets blown up and then he's brought into the Colosseum. You know, it's very like surrealist.
Tamor said there was no way I could film it, like, you know, in Rome, also in Cinecittà, without like just automatically referencing Fellini. She was like, it's kind of the clay stuff apparently is because the terracotta soldiers, that huge exhibition happened around about the same time. Yeah. So even though that's obviously culturally completely unrelated, like, she just had the visual as like a really strong contemporary visual. And she was like, wouldn't it be cool if we were blending this kind of reanimation of the dead and this past culture, but using the image that's probably most evocative of that in 1999, which is not classical. It's this terracotta army, right? Mm-hmm. It was wild. Like, everyone had seen these pictures, right? They were on magazines everywhere. And tons of people went to it was a traveling exhibition.
I remember, I saw them in Houston, I think. Or at least they had like two of them.
I saw them somewhere too. I can't remember where now.
And I love that, like, Tamor had clearly got the fact that the original is just like intertextually exuberant, like it just refers to everything. I mean, we've been talking about like layers. It's almost like a pathology, right? Like, it's normally you'd want to damp down some of the referentiality to like maintain a sense of unity, and, you know, Peele and Shakespeare were like, you know, screw that. And like, unity is so, like, you know, tame and yesterday. So I feel that she really got that. And so, like, she didn't have any inhibition. I mean, yes, you have, like, fascist plus, like, ancient Rome, but you also have the contemporary stuff, and you even have, you know, this Far Eastern referentiality as well. She's just, like, willing to put it all in there.
Yeah.
I think that's something that's really interesting, because this movie, in a lot of ways, follows very closely to the play. Mm-hmm. But you can almost do that because the play itself just had so much fun with dealing with source material that was not historical in any sense.
It was impressionistic, right? Like, it's the impression if you've read a bunch of stuff about Rome and had to recall it in a fever dream.
It's like a nostalgia. It's like there's a familiarity to it, and yet it's wholly unrecognizable as like, oh, this is what this is referencing of like Roman history, because it, and I think that's what made it fun and interesting. I think that's where we get caught up on reception too, is like, are people trying to be too faithful to original course material? Is it not adapting enough for a modern audience? Or is the way they adapt it just too frustrating for us? And I feel like this movie actually did a really good job of like, okay, yeah, we're following really close to the play, but we're adding elements that are still going to be really recognizable to a modern audience, and still unrecognizable as a actual event in Roman history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, because the play itself is like a work of reception that's sort of, you know, smashing together all of these, yeah, like Colin said, a fever dream of just like Roman tropes of like, mm-hmm. you know, semi-historical, like, you know, semi-mythological, just inside jokes almost. Yeah. Of like, oh yeah, oh, he cut off his hand, like, oh haha. Like, and yeah. like we're knowing like all the like the weird histories that Livy talks about, or like, you know, we're hearing all of the mutilation stories in our heads. And I think, yeah, it's a more fun Shakespeare almost. Like the histories can be kind of boring. I don't know. I love all Shakespeare, as I said, but like the histories can be kind of you're maybe more supposed to be, you know, sticking to the actual rules of history. And this is just sort of throwing all of that out the window to the best, mm-hmm. like the best like results.
In the scene in the woods with Harry Lennox, or actually right after Harry Lennox leaves, where Bassianus and Lavinia like confront her, they have like a very long sort of bit about Actaeon. And they're yeah. like, I wish I were Diana so I could turn you into a deer. And then it turns into a bunch of horn puns.
Right.
Which turned into a bunch of sex puns.
Right.
And
I was going to say there was a line of interpretation on the play, I think it was in like the 1980s, which I think rightly saw it as a satire on people who had a lot of learning, but that was very superficial. It's kind of a satire on a certain type of humanist learning, or humanist learning done badly. So mm-hmm. in the scene where the arrows are wrapped with this message and Karin and Demetrius are like, recalling this line from Horace to try and interpret it. And like Aaron gets it, right? Karin and Demetrius don't get it. They get like the literal line from Horace, but they don't understand the significance of it. And Aaron is basically in an aside telling the audience how stupid they are for not really understanding what the message is, which is that Titus knows what's up.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so that was taken as a kind of a capsule for what's going on in the play as a whole, that like people have all of these references, but it doesn't amount to anything. It's just like Oxford witticisms. It's not like, right? And I find that especially funny with like the Bannon story in the background, because Bannon's obsessed with Marcus Aurelius, right? And like all of this Stoic stuff that I find really weird. Like everyone's obsessed with Neo-Stoicism right now and like resilience. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's basically all about individualism. Mm-hmm. And right. it often feels like, you know, oh yeah, you've got all of the references, but it's just very self-serving, right? It doesn't amount mm-hmm. to anything at all. And so in some ways, I think, you know, everyone attacks the play for being superficial, but like, it's actually a critique of superficiality. It's not yeah. even one that you have to work at. Like in the play, there's a character who's just like, don't be superficial or bad things will happen to you. So actually, yeah. He's young, Shakespeare, and maybe the guy that he's working with, if that really is the nature of the composition, you know, he was a bit more mature, but like, I actually think it's a surprisingly mature work. And I actually want to reverse the chronology, where we typically think of things as, oh well, it was young and immature and then like he got better as an artist. But maybe like the experimentation was what was interesting, but then you have to work through more like naturalistic versions, which are kind of more instinctively appealing and they're mature in some ways, but that's what's going to enable you to understand what the experimentation was doing the first time around. It was just a bit raw and like in your face the first time around. Mm-hmm. But the innovation actually is there. It's not 10, 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff 10, 20 years later is easier for us to like, but that doesn't mean that it's the more interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Sorry, Eli, did you have?
No, it was mostly just my love for Aaron just like being like looking at the camera and just like, oh my God. It's like he does that, I think, a few times where he like mm-hmm. looks at the camera. He's like, okay.
Him and Jessica Lange are the ones who have like, and I think Anthony Hopkins does it maybe once or twice, but they both have like direct to camera monologues where they're talking to someone and then they just turn and look straight into the camera and they're like, this is what I'm doing, my manifesto or whatever. Yeah. But I was going to segue into like, we should talk a little bit more about Aaron, because by the end of the movie I'm like, Aaron I think is my favorite character, who at the end is like, you all suck. This all sucks. My only regret in life is that I didn't do more bad things to all of you. which I kind of was like, Aaron is like, you know, I know maybe he's like a sort of cartoonishly vilified person, and right, particularly as like he's the only basically non-white character, or he's one of like three non-white characters in Shakespeare, and that he's you know, you could see him as sort of cartoonishly villainous. But I sort of was like, Aaron was my sort of silent hero. I don't know. He seemed to have gotten it better than everybody else. And also, I just respect the energy of like, you all suck. I will take you all down with me.
Yes, he's cartoonish and is villainy, but he also has such great lines. Mm-hmm. And I think Harry Lennox does an amazing job. Like,
so good.
He almost like out-acts Anthony Hopkins. I mean, it takes quite a lot to do that.
Yeah.
But I don't see it as possible to write the part of Aaron with like a purely like Bannon-like racism in mind, right? Which is very like, it's really like primitive, that, right? It's very like good and evil, better and worse, right? So yeah, you know, Shakespeare was writing in, you know, what we would regard today as a, you know, racist context or whatever. But like, you don't write Aaron's part as charismatically as you do if your intent, even like your tertiary intent, is primarily to like to make some kind of racist claim. Like, it just isn't supported by the part at all. I think everyone's reaction to reading the play is like, man, Aaron's a great character.
And I kind of wanted him to get away with it.
I know. If I could change one thing, is that Aaron wouldn't have gotten caught at the end, but...
Well, and it leaves it ambiguous enough. I'm like, yeah, he's buried chest deep in a hole. But then the kid walks off with the baby and he's like, but Aaron's still technically alive at the moment. So maybe he literally wiggles his way out of that one.
We also should probably, I mean, maybe also the sort of framing device, which is the younger Lucius, which for the first like half of the movie is the silent. So we're introduced with this like kid. I guess, I mean, maybe it's just me being dumb, but I later realized was Titus's grandson, you know, Lucius II, who's sort of there throughout the entire film, although just more as a witness than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
He's just kind of, you know, going along, seeing all of this. And then at the end, he walks away with Aaron's baby. And I don't know, I'm sort of formulating my idea of what that kid is like. What's the deal with this kid?
I love this Titus fan fiction with the young Lucius as the protagonist.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'd had this thought earlier when we were talking about the opening. It opens with him playing with action figures, and like, you know, if we're taking this movie, if like, is there a serious message at the end? And Lige says, war is bad. I'm like, that's kind of, here we are, is instilling in a young boy, oh, war is fun, with your action figures playing out these roles. And then you witness this entire bloody violent tragedy. And I kept going back to Astyanax in some ways, like to earlier Greek plays, of, you know, to avoid revenge being taken in the future, you have to get rid of any possible threat to the future.
Throw that kid off the wall. Yeah,
exactly. Yep. And then, but it doesn't happen here. The, you know, as Colin pointed out, it's like, this could very easily, act five could be act one of the next revenge tragedy play we watch. And so ending with, instead of like something bad happening to the infant, you actually have Lucius carrying the kid off to safety in the sunset. It could be like an ask to us, like, now that you've seen all how horrible this really is, maybe no. Maybe just walk off into the sunset and call it a day.
Yeah, leave. You got to leave Rome.
It was interesting looking back at the beginning with all the toys, because I think some of them you can like kind of point to set pieces that happen in the movie. Like there are two soldiers like army crawling and he squirts ketchup or something on them.
Which I gotta say, stressed me like right the fuck out, because like, I hate messiness with food. And I was watching this kid playing, I was like having this kid needs to stop.
Imagine having that hang up. But having children, that's why.
I'm probably not. Like, this is like, I have my limits, and that's one of them. Like, food messiness is like, no, bridge too far.
But then there was also like the two army crawlers were probably like Karen and Demetrius, and then there's like a weird cake that was probably like where Lucius and the Goths were gathering. It was like the same as that like rock formation that they were like, at. So he's
quarry,
like, this kid,
or whatever they are. Yeah.
Yeah, this kid is like enacting the movie. And like creating this like really horrific, like terrible mess. and is then like forced to actually see it with real living human beings.
But he's kind of up until the moment he lives it, he's loving it, right?
Like, yeah, he was like having a great time. And then when like the real bomb went off and the windows caved in, it's like the real life element to it that like if you, you know, play with your toys all you want, but this is not how human beings should maybe actually interact.
So Taymor talks about that, and I can't remember whether it's the interview or the behind the scenes thing, but she talks about the connection between violence as entertainment and violence in the course of the film. And she's like, I try to make that very explicit through the opening scene and through other aspects of the film. But like as often with these claims about, I mean, part of the problem is that there is no like explicit claim, right? So anytime anyone talks about visualizing violence or entertainment, I don't know what they're actually saying, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I appreciate that, like, it is a topic of discourse, right? People talk about it. And there's a group that feels that it has a deleterious effect on children, right? But I don't know what filmmakers are really saying. It never seems like an argument. It always just seems like, hey, I'm just putting out in front of you that, you know, we glorify in some sense violence, or we like get entertainment out of it. And I'm like, okay, sure, we know that, but so what? Like, what do we do with that? Yeah.
Well, and here's, you know, 2.5 hours of violence. Like,
that's like kind of fun at some level, right? Like,
yeah, and she knows that, right? She knows that she's giving you entertainment, but she's offering you some kind of critique, but I never know what to do with it. Right. I'm like, okay, so I appreciate that. Like, am I supposed to feel like really morally compromised? Am I supposed to like do something in particular at the end of it, like mentally in my interpretation of the film? Like, I don't know.
It's sort of like the very, I don't know, like a scene that some people get hung up on is at the very end of Wolf of Wall Street, where like the final shot is just a picture of like an enraptured audience listening to this guy talk about business ethics or something like that. And like the thesis sort of seems to be like, Jordan, the villain isn't Jordan Belfort because he like does all this like grifting and conning and theft or whatever. Like the villain is you for like lapping this shit up. And yeah, is that like sort of the point, right? Like, are we supposed to feel guilty for enjoying over the top violence?
I mean, I can't say that at the end of the movie I've ever felt guilt, because I don't know. It feels pretty easy to compartmentalize those two things, and it always feels like the director wants to be like, ah, but it is not so easy to compartmentalize them. I'm like, okay, well,
yeah.
I don't know how to shake myself out of my misapprehension, but like I've always felt resolutely confident that I'm
right.
Watch the movie and then go out and like exact any kind of retribution on anyone. So I really don't understand what the
Steve Bannons of the world.
Yeah, I'm like, Steve Bannon might get a different impression out of it, but I don't think that's the movie's fault.
Yeah, I think that's art in general too, right? Like, art is just meant to make us feel something, but that just because we feel something doesn't mean it's going to make us act on that feeling. Because, like, I think Handmaid's Tale is another good example of, like, there's definitely some really political messaging happening there. It's like, do you not realize how bad it can be? And yet, at the same time, it's a show, and we can somehow, because it's fantasy, we can remove ourselves from the reality that it's trying to portray in a fictional way. And it's like, well, my mind can successfully separate those things as real and not real. So the message gets lost.
Right. I mean, I feel there's like a world of difference between, you know, most depictions of violence and like, you know, I read a news report the other day that video on TikTok of that Wagner mercenary who'd been like, I think had defected maybe to the Ukrainian army and then had been recaptured and was executed like on video and had been shared like and viewed like hundreds of thousands of times. And I was like, well, you know, that's qualitatively very different, and I see how that's problematic, and there's a serious like ethical and legal case for various platforms to consider about what they're willing to display and why, and like similar kinds of discussions are happening about Twitter, and TikTok obviously has a, you know, a lower threshold for acceptability than Twitter has, and you know there's lots of, you know, important discussion to be had about that. But I don't know where something like Taymor's commentary really like intersects with that at all. It seems so rarefied and really in the realm of entertainment. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for it to kind of get out of that and comment on, you know, just the availability of depictions of violence in general. I mean, is she making a claim about censorship? I mean, if so, she should come out and make that claim, you know? It'd just be easier, I think, to understand.
A point of comparison that I immediately just thought about is, like, Paul Verhoeven's films, because the synthesis of Paul Verhoeven is he's this wacky Dutch guy who's, like, fascinated in, like, an anthropological sense with, like, American pop culture. And he makes movies like RoboCop and Starship Troopers and Total Recall that are so, like, over-the-top violence. And part of an element is, like, you guys like this? Like, why do you think this is okay? Yeah. Like, you like this kind of stuff? And he makes, like, the most absurdly grotesque, violent, you know, sort of American blockbuster. And people are like, yes, more, right? Or, like, RoboCop is fantastic. And then, you know, that's also, I mean, a lot of his films are, like, deeply satirical. I mean, RoboCop, obviously. And Starship Troopers is the satire maybe isn't totally functioning, or the story, the satire is there, but the story isn't all there. But, like, a lot of it is in a way of just being like kind of a commentary on, like, American pop culture fixations with, like, violence and authoritarianism and things like that.
But, well, and I think there's something to keep in mind, because now we're turning to the problem that true crime is becoming our entertainment. Like, Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, like, those real serial criminals that,
right, yeah,
and now we are casting Zac Efron and
but what if they were sexy?
Yeah, and it's like, and now we've fictionalized what was a very true story.
Yeah,
and what is that doing to us?
Yeah, that still has, like, effects on living people, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there are still people whose, you know, family members or who knew someone who was, you know, murdered or killed, and now they see those murderers on TV as, you know, portrayed as sexy. And, like, that has to be the weirdest, like, mind flip. And I think the huge ethical questions about, you know, how appropriate is any of that is really something that we should be talking about, because I have also maybe just doing my job now. I have a lot of feelings
truly
about
experiencing true crime.
And yeah, I think that there are so many deeply ethical and disturbing questions that maybe people who just have no concept of that or who have never been touched by that type of violence do not understand at all. And it should absolutely be up to the people who have been touched by that those types of violence to, you know, say whether that story can be told, in what way that story should be told. And I think the entertainment factor is incredibly disturbing there.
And that took a dark turn.
Sorry.
We're just over an hour. I want to make sure, Prom, we don't have a, but I want to make sure you don't have, like, a hard out or something you got to run off to.
I mean, I can hear the kids in the background. I think they've done nothing so far that warrants, like, emergency editing. But
yeah, nothing's, there's been no shatters.
At some point, they will presumably increase the volume level or the damage level, and I'll have
fair. But in that case, it seems like we're approaching the avenue of final thoughts. Is there anything that people wanted to get out about this film that hasn't gotten out yet?
I do. I have Jessica Lange thoughts and just Tamara thoughts in general. I don't know, at the end, you know, they say that she isn't, you know, buried with anybody. She's thrown to wild beasts, like, in the story, because she was terrible and awful. And it makes me kind of sad, because I think she, I don't know, she made a lot of very poor choices, but I think she was also trying to do a lot to survive. And yeah, I want a story from Tamara's perspective. I think that would be, like, really weird, but also interesting. And Jessica Lange was incredible, as always. Every word she said was brilliant.
Yeah, great. She's also very hot. Everyone's very hot. Even Titus is pretty hot. I was going to say, if we were to have a Rosencrantz Guildenstern kind of, like,
yes, you
know, version, I want it from Marcus Andronicus, and I would call it Everybody Around Me is Completely Insane. where he feels like the one sort of relatively normal, even-keeled character, and he's like, yes, what if we had an election? And everyone's like, what if I just murdered everybody?
I agree. That's amazing.
There's a great bit with Colm Feore in the making of, where he's clearly really agitated that studios won't support this to, like, the amount that they should. So even though it was, like, the budget was pretty generous, right, for something like this. It was like $25 million or something like that. Mm-hmm. But she wanted more, and she felt she could do more with more. And he's just like, you know, there are all these Hollywood movies that, you know, tons of people die. It's like a genocide and they get financed. And like, you know, you just have one like hand lopping, like one rape, and then they won't give you any money. you could have phrased that a little differently.
Yeah.
I get your point. But, yeah.
Lord.
I think there's like one moment I want to go back and watch again, but I thought it was hilarious, was Lavinia going through the whole scene of like Philomela and finding the metamorphoses, and then like, oh, the man's like, I have this brilliant idea. Here's the staff, and like, I'm gonna mimic like how you can write in the sand. She like watches him for a moment and then like grabs it. I think she doesn't even bother like with her hands. No. She's just like straight mouth, like, I'm gonna make this work. And then it flashes all of these background scenes that I was like half paying attention to, and I need to go look at that moment again and be like,
we haven't really talked enough about the like, yeah, the interludes of like the, I don't know what to how to describe them, like
fever dreams.
Yeah, they're like, they're almost like they're like an like a Roger Moore era Bond opening credits, where it's like, mm-hmm, superimposed images of animals and women and music. It's like, in this kind of, again, very like impressionistic,
mm-hmm,
which I guess is sort of the spirit of theater. It's like, it's all about the feeling, and it doesn't have to like make sense at any sort of like practical way or logical way.
Yeah. Well, similar to Elijah's whole thought of like Tamara dying at the end in a very, very sad way. It's like, also Lavinia survived literally all of this, got the information out.
Yeah,
and then it ends in fairly, you know, a very Roman way of like, yeah, oh, she was, yeah, raped, dead.
Next,
like,
snap.
Damn, yeah, it.
So this is part of, I'm just going to say Shakespeare. I've no, I mean, Shakespeare and Peele, whatever. But like, the critique is of the hyper-masculinity of all of these guys. Like, Lucius is clearly taking some extraordinary satisfaction in just the complete disrespect of Tamara's body, right? Like, it's, mm-hmm, it's just the umpteenth example of a certain type of hyper-masculine man being a hyper-masculine man. Like, oh, yeah, you know, Titus getting to decide if his daughter lives or dies, right? Like, mm-hmm, obviously, like, the rape, you know, who gets to marry whom. It's just one episode after another of, you know, men making these kinds of patriarchal moves and enforcing them with violence, and then that being symptomatic of a state that's in complete collapse. So in a weird way, it actually seems like one of the more feminist of Shakespeare's, I mean, you know, not that his plays are like anti-feminist, but it seems to be one that in its anti-masculine perspective is, yeah, feminist, even from the outset of his career. Because like, it's a, yeah, very male play, but you actually get more sympathy towards the marginalized characters than you do towards any of the protagonists or the secondary male,
yeah,
characters.
Yeah.
And I think she captures that, partly because Jessica Lange does like an amazing job. And I actually don't know who the actress who plays Lavinia, but
I've got it right here. It's
Breaking Bad, and she was in The Knight's Tale.
I think she's a British.
It's Laura Fraser is the actress's name.
So what's interesting is that she was very apprehensive about doing Shakespeare in English, and her accent is not like, you know, received pronunciation, you know, RADA trained. I mean, she may have gone to RADA, but her natural accent is not.
She's
that
Scottish.
And, yeah. Yeah, she expressed an anxiety about doing the lines in a way that would evoke the correct response from the audience, and I would never have known that from the way, yeah, she does it. Like, yeah, it's flawless. Mm-hmm. But she does say it in the behind the scenes movie. But even she has her, like, one of the great things about the way she does it is even she has her unsympathetic moments as well. Mm-hmm. So there's no like purism. And it's another, yeah, reason I really like the play, like, you know, that there's no, like, you'd have thought early in the career that there would be a bit of like, ah, this is a more heroic or sympathetic figure. But actually every sympathy evoked is done for characters who are like problematic in some way. Even Lavinia, who's like, she's basically a bit like hoity-toity, right? At part,
yeah,
she's
more
like, yeah, you know, I'm better than you, I'm purer than you, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they have, she has that very, right before Bassianus is murdered, she has that, they have that kind of mean girl moment where they're like,
yeah,
they're ribbing Tamara for the, like, oh, we caught you in the woods with Aaron, and like, you're done now.
Right. And there's kind of a, like a very thinly veiled racism to it as well.
Oh, not even, yeah, yeah, not even that thin.
Thinly,
it's pretty explicit, right?
So, yeah, I think it's, you know, it's actually, it's a weirdly like progressive you know, even in today's context, I think it's a weirdly progressive play and adaptation.
All right. I think that seems like a great place to sort of put a pie in it. let's put this pie in the oven.
Yeah, stick a fork in it. We're done.
Yeah, grinded into paste. Pramit, thank you so much for joining us. So it was lovely having you back. We had a great time. Hope you enjoyed talking Titus.
Yeah, I did. Love it. Especially introducing you to the hours you're going to spend on the internet looking up Steve Bannon.
Oh, I'm so excited, Pramit.
Eli has never been this excited to Google Steve Bannon in her life.
I don't think anyone has been.
Truly.
Truly.
All right, amazing. Pramit, if people want to hear, read, see more from you, where can they do that?
So I have a very specific thing. In 2023, probably in April, there will be an exhibition on Black classicists in Central Texas, focused on the Austin area, but in Central Texas. And we're going to be hosting a physical exhibition at the Benson and the Carver Museum and Houston Tillotson Library in Austin, but there'll be a digital component as well. So when the website's up for that, I will send it to you and you can publicize it if you wouldn't mind. And people
can take a look,
because it's a great history of people reading Caesar and Marcus Aurelius and not being Steve Bannon about it, and also building physical institutions where these things were taught and, you know, advancing their community. So it's like, it's kind of like a liberal arts dream. So I hope I can bring more people's attention to that. And Colin, you know this because you are the person who started this all off. So,
well, sort of. I did some preliminary work.
Well, it's happening.
Now, I'm really excited to hear that. That's really fun. Yeah, in that case, thank you all so much. Thank you for listening. As usual, listeners, you can find us at moviesweedig.com. Follow us at @digmovies, at least for the time being, while Twitter still exists. We'll see. By the time I get around to editing this, the situation might be different, but we'll see. And yeah, you can follow us on all the major streaming services. Of course, as always, please like, review, subscribe, all that good business. Thank you all, and I'll see you guys around the bend. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.